that probably is the next step that Pakistan is going to take this matter to the UN. But what is the most worrying thing is that we are hearing reports of troops movement on the Pakistani side of Kashmir. This is almost a routine. Whenever there's heightened tensions between the two countries on the Kashmir issues.
Shares in Cathay Pacific have fallen sharply after the airline complied with a Chinese order to dismiss staff found to have taken part in protests in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong flag carrier suspended a pilot and fired two airport employees. Police and pro-democracy protesters have clashed again in Hong Kong. A demonstration is underway at the airport. Here's Stephen McDonnell.
There are, I think, so many people at the airport now protesting, in part because of the clashes we saw over the weekend. By going to the airport, although it's another unauthorised protest, it has been peaceful there for the last 4 days. They're not blocking people getting off flights, there are corridors, but it is a good focal point. And also, they're complaining about the way the Cathay staff have been treated.
News from the BBC. Authorities in China say the death toll from a powerful storm battering the country's eastern seaboard has surpassed 44, with at least 20 people still unaccounted for. More than 6 million people have been affected by Typhoon Lei Kimar since it made landfall near Shanghai on Saturday, bringing heavy rainstorms, flash floods and landslides. The opposition candidate in Argentina's primary election is celebrating a significant lead over the incumbent, Mauricio Macri, ahead of the presidential election in October. With four-fifths of the votes counted, the Peronist Alberto Fernandez is on more than 47%, a full 14 percentage points ahead of Mr. Macri, whose harsh austerity measures appear to have been rejected by the electorate. Police in the Philippines have confirmed that at least three people were shot dead on Sunday during a major police operation in a Manila suburb.
Where hope and healing meet.
Of something systemic.
Well, I think he's something systemic. I think that Donald Trump, when you look at his rhetoric, when you look at his campaign, you're looking at someone who's saying that we should be fearing Muslims because they're terrorizing us. You're talking about a candidate, a president who's saying that black communities are infested with danger and they're so dangerous and people are living in hell. These ideas are widespread, and they were widespread before the emergence of Trump. Trump, of course, just seeped into that well and formulated a political project around those ideas.
So is there a part of you, as your expertise and your sort of academic devotion is to studying anti-racism and the degrees to which you can improve race relations in the United States, is a part of you thinking to yourself, maybe there's something positive about the Trump presidency? He's lifting a veil, being more honest about feelings which are deeply entrenched in some parts of the nation.
I think that many Americans are not able really to deny how powerful and how pervasive racism still is in America. And so they're opening up, therefore, two more serious conversations about the history and presence of racism. They're becoming more serious about the need to be anti-racist. Some of them are recognizing that they don't want to be like Trump and identify as not racist in the way white nationalists and Trump do, and they see the role of anti-racism. So that's certainly a good thing.
You raise a lot of things there. We'll get to white nationalism as a phenomenon a little later, but it seems to me you want Americans to take sides. In fact, you seem to suggest they have a duty to take sides, to become very engaged in all of this. You say there is no in-between safe space of defining yourself as not racist. You're either racist, you say, or you're anti-racist. Not racism as a phenomenon, a neutrality maybe, that's simply a mask to hide racism.
It is. And when we, most Americans strive to identify themselves as not racist. And I guess what we don't realize, though, is so too with segregationists, so too with slaveholders, so too with slave traders, so too do white nationalists self-identify as not racist. And when we ask them, Well, what does it mean to be not racist? They can't really answer that question because there's nothing that not racist really has no meaning. It's essentially saying, no, no matter what I say, no matter what I do, I'm not racist. And so as a term that doesn't have any meaning, we should potentially give up that term.
I instinctively think it does have meaning. It means I don't have instinctive or inbuilt prejudice as far as I am aware. In the sense that I know myself, mm-hmm. I can say, I don't have racist feelings, and you're delegitimizing that as a feeling I can have.
So then my response would be, so then what feelings do you have? In other words, an anti-racist believes that the racial groups are equals. A racist believes that certain racial groups are better and worse than others. And so oftentimes people are in denial about the ways in which they may actually think that certain racial groups are better or worse than others.
So is it unconscious to a certain extent, the racism that may be in me?
I think in many ways we aren't conscious. So the way, for instance, I would ask a person to figure out whether there are ideas that they're unconscious about is I'd ask them, why does this racial disparity exist? So to give an example, in the United States, Black people are twice as likely to be unemployed. So I would ask an American, why is that the case? And some Americans don't consciously realize that they believe that the disparity exists because there's something wrong with Black workers. Or they don't realize that that idea is a racist idea.
If you tell me just defining yourself as not racist has no real meaning, mm-hmm. what is the real meaning then of being anti-racist?
Sure. So to me, the meaning of being anti-racist, first and foremost, is recognizing the way in which we have been trained, we've been nurtured in many ways to look out at our racially unequal society and think the cause of that is something wrong with people of color. It causes us to identify, confess, admit the way in which we've been trained to sort of see racial hierarchy. And then it causes us to say, you know what? I'm going to be different. I'm going to see the racial groups as equals. I'm going to challenge racist policies. I'm going to be very active in eliminating racial disparities in my nation.
And you have to be active. That's your message.
Because can you imagine if you do nothing in the face of racial disparities, what's going to happen? They're going to remain. And so doing nothing is literally allowing racial disparities to persist.
Is there something in your own background that brought you to this understanding of racism? I want you to tell me what growing up as a kid in New York drew you to these ideas.
Well, I mean, I how to be an anti-racist is largely a confessional. It's a confessional of my journey, my journey being raised to believe that there was something wrong with Black people.
You mean you were raised to be a racist?
I was raised to be a racist. And I think it's common in America to be raised to believe there's something wrong with a particular racial group.
And yet, you know, in your book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, you emphasize that your parents, you know, they were very active, caring parents. They wanted the best for you. They also were very sort of conscious of politics, of the liberation struggle, all sorts of stuff. You would think that would be an environment where you would be encouraged and raised to absolutely not be racist.
And I think it really shows the complexities, right? That it's not just good people, right? I mean, I should say bad people. It's not just people who are white nationalists who think that there's something wrong with a particular racial group. And in the 80s and the 90s, there were dominant ideas, even among people who were liberal, even among people who had came out of the civil rights movement, that the reason why so many Black people were still poor, the reason why so many Black people were being mass incarcerated was because of their behavioral or cultural deficiencies, that Black people need to take personal responsibility. And these were the ideas that were dominant in the 90s, so much so that I consumed them wholesale.
So you're sort of blaming your parents for your racism as a youth. I just wonder how your parents feel about that, given that they are classic, liberal, civil rights-oriented Black parents.
So I think my parents actually like me. I think we've, I guess, commonly moved away from these ideas, as right. I think many Americans have in general. I mean, I think many Americans, for instance, are looking back at the 94 crime bill and seeing that as a problem. And so in many ways, many Americans have moved to be more anti-racist. And so I think many Americans are recognizing that those ideas they believed in the 90s were indeed racist.
You talk of shame about some of the things you used to believe as a teenager. I think there was one famous, well, I know there was from the book, there was this famous moment when you were in a oratory competition at high school. You gave this incredibly impressive speech, in essence, sort of blaming black youth for some of their own problems. And now you say you're ashamed.
Yeah, I'm completely ashamed. It's hard for me to even watch that speech. I have it on like this little VHS tape. And because I was led to believe that the problems of black youth, what black youth were struggling with, what was causing them to have problems, was not racist policies, was not racial profiling, was not them being mass incarcerated, was not them being four times more likely to be unemployed than they were two generations ago. It was because of their own behavioral problems. So in this speech I gave for this Martin Luther King oratorical contest in 2000, and I was a senior in high school, I basically said that. I said that, you know, what's wrong with black youth is that they don't value education. What's wrong with black youth is that they're too oftentimes getting pregnant. What's wrong with black youth is their parents aren't raising them. And any time we say there's something wrong with a racial group, we're expressing a racist idea.
You clearly have been brave in the sense that you've said, look, black people can be racist just as easily as white people can, if I'm paraphrasing you correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what you seem to be doing is going through U.S. history, because, you know, in the books you've written, you basically, in one of them, you've rather arrogantly declared a definitive history of racism in the United States. You catalogue racism and you include in the racist camp people like Frederick Douglass, for example, and even at times you suggest Barack Obama had very significant elements of racism in his political approach and thinking. So, frankly, who isn't racist?
Well, I think in Stamped from the Beginning, which I think is the book you're referencing, which was a long sort of history of racist ideas, what I did was very simple. I defined a racist idea, which was any idea that suggests a racial group was superior or inferior to another racial group in any way. And then that book specifically chronicled anti-black racist ideas. So ideas suggesting that there was something wrong with black people. And so over the course of history, you've had people who've either said there's something genetically wrong with black people, culturally wrong with black people as a group, or behaviorally wrong with black people. And when I came to that definition, I then went in search of history, and I was not going to exclude someone because I appreciated them, like Frederick Douglass, who's one of my heroes. Mm. I wasn't going to exclude someone. If someone said that there was something wrong with black people, and if someone says something is wrong with black people today, someone is expressing a racist idea.
And to bring it more up to date, and a giant of contemporary U.S. politics, Barack Obama, whose presidency, two-term presidency, we're also familiar with, are you suggesting that there were ways in which Obama was racist in his approach to race issues and his messages to black people in America?
So I think one of his most brilliant speeches was the race speech he gave in Philadelphia during his campaign in 2008.
Known as the race speech.
Yeah, the race speech. And I think we should very critically and closely read that speech yet again. And I mean, it was a brilliant speech. And in many ways, he spoke about the racial discrimination, or I should say racist policies, that were prevailing in America. But at times, he talked about this idea that there was something that black people were not doing. And so to give an example, he would speak about black people in a way being defeatist. In other words, because of these sort of generations of discrimination, some black people have stopped trying. And that is the reason why some of these disparities exist. And so I'm going to critique that. Mm. He also, at a time, spoke about there is some truth in white anxieties. And these are sort of ideas that suggest that part of the reason these disparities exist is because of what black people are not doing, or that there's some truth in white racist ideas.
Do you not believe at all in the sort of the notion of uplift, of inspiration, of aspiration, and that there are individuals like Obama who can have enormous positive impact through the arc of a career like his?
Oh, without question. And I think that's a different sort of conversation. I mean, obviously, Barack Obama has inspired millions of people around the world.
But would it be wrong to say he has particularly inspired black Americans?
Oh, without question.
Yeah.
He has inspired black Americans, and he's still beloved among black Americans. And I think what I'm trying to really get at, we too often want to exclude or include people, typically ourselves, from whether they are ever expressing racist ideas or whether they're ever supporting policies that actually create more racial inequity. And I think what we need to do as humanity, talking about this racial issue, is define terms. Define what a racist idea is, and whoever says that idea, call it racist. Define what a racist is, and whoever acts that way, call them racist. That's essentially what I'm seeking to do, and it doesn't really matter who the person is, nor does it matter how much I admire them. If they say something that suggests that there's something wrong with a racial group, not an individual, but a racial group, then that is a problem.
How do you reach out to white America with your message about anti-racism and the need to be proactively engaged with it?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think many white Americans, one of the reasons why they resist acknowledging their racism is because they have been taught, like people worldwide, that racist as a term is a label, it's a tattoo, it's a fixed identity, it is a bad person.
It's deeply pejorative. It's an insult.
It's an insult. But you know who also said that it was an insult? Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer, the white nationalist, once wrote that, you know, racist isn't a descriptive term, it's a pejorative term. But I would argue with Richard Spencer that no, racist is a descriptive term. It describes when a person is saying there's something wrong with a particular racial group. It describes when someone is doing nothing in the face of racial inequity. It describes when someone is supporting a policy that's creating more racial inequity. And what's interesting about that term, like anti-racist, is one minute I can say something that is deep, that is racist. I can say, you know what, this is what's wrong with black people. And then the very next minute I can say, well, this is the ways in which the racial groups are equals.
I'm just wondering, with your fascinating but nonetheless quite abstract theorizing about some of this, whether you are failing to sort of reach out to the hearts and minds of ordinary folk. Because in essence, what you're saying to many ordinary Americans, and let's focus on white Americans right now, is that they are racist. Their instinctive reaction to that is going to be one of absolute indignation. We are not racist, they'll say. And, you know, if you say, but hang on a minute, you know, what are you doing to fight the presidency of Donald Trump, a man who has, as we discussed at the beginning of this interview, has used all sorts of epithets and words about immigrants and people of color that many regard as unacceptable. What are you doing to fight it? And they might say, well, we're going to vote against him. Is that enough?
For me, no. I mean, part of this also is, you know, what I would say to white Americans is, has racism benefited you more than in a more egalitarian society? Because one of the things that I think we've been misled to believe is that I think people recognize, and it's true, that racism benefits white people in the United States more than people of color. But the question is, if we had a truly egalitarian society where bigotry in no form dominated, because in many ways racism informs other forms of bigotry, if people were not being able to be manipulated into voting for a candidate due to their racist ideas, and instead they were able to vote for whatever candidate pushed whatever policies benefited them, what would actually happen is the white middle classes and white working classes would actually have more than they do now. They'd be more egalitarian or equalizing in society.
And yeah, that's fascinating, but I will then point to one specific measure that you regard as fundamentally important to the anti-racist agenda and to genuine racial justice, and that is reparations.
Yeah.
And your message is that the United States of America needs to make massive financial reparation, compensation, to those ancestors, descendants of the slaves who were enslaved for so long, suffered so much, and of course whose descendants are the black Americans of today. Mm-hmm. It would cost upwards of $1 trillion for meaningful compensation to be delivered. Mm-hmm. Most Americans regard that as both impractical, but also probably unjust, because they personally are not responsible.
Well, first, actually, that's not how I would frame the reparations debate. You know, how I sort of frame the reparations debate is currently we have a racial wealth gap in the United States. The white median wealth is about 10 times more than black median wealth. And that racial gap is actually growing, such that by 2050, forecasters are estimating that black median wealth will redline at $0. And during that same period, white median wealth would have grown. So we have a growing racial wealth gap. And what I ask of my fellow Americans is, how do we reduce that racial wealth gap, which is both the result of past and present racist policies, without reparations? That's the question that I ask. And I would be more than willing to think about any other sort of policy that can reduce the racial wealth gap, if it's not reparations.
I just want to quote to you, because this is such a live debate right now. There was congressional testimony about the idea of reparations recently, and one black commentator, I believe he's a respected commentator in the United States, Coleman Hughes, he says this. He said, "I worry that our desire to fix the past compromises our ability to fix the present. There is a difference between acknowledging history and allowing history to distract us from the problems we face today. Black people don't need an apology. We need safer neighborhoods, better schools, better criminal justice system." Do you accept the logic of his argument?
Well, I mean, what I would say in response to his argument is that when you think about wealth, wealth is the combination of the past and the present, right? You have people who pass on wealth. You have people who inherit wealth, where you have people who invest and that wealth grows over time. And so you can't, when you're talking about a racial wealth gap, separate the past from the present. The past is the present, particularly as it relates to wealth, which is why something like reparations, which both combines the past and the present, is an effective strategy. And again,
aren't you setting up to fail? Because we've been here before. In the early 2000s, there was a movement to have reparations put on the political agenda. It died, it failed. It's almost certainly going to fail again, certainly in the current political climate. So if you push reparations as the ultimate litmus test of whether America is serious about dismantling racism, then you're setting up for failure, for a very negative and bleak outlook.
So I wouldn't say that it is the ultimate litmus test. I would say it's the litmus test to determine whether someone is serious about eliminating the specific racial wealth gap. That's one of the many sort of serious racial disparities we have in our society. Now, there are other litmus tests that for other specific issues, but this is just one of many. And in terms of the cost of reparations, you know, we can't forget in the United States that half of our federal budget goes to the military. That when you talk about the war on terror, you're talking about a war that costs trillions and trillions of dollars that many Americans opposed. And so the idea that there is no money to literally provide reparations, it actually can be shifting money from places and spaces that Americans actually don't necessarily support.
In nothing more than a few words, do you think America is traveling in the right direction in terms of addressing its race challenge?
So actually, I think there are two cars, and one is traveling in the right direction, the anti-racist car, and the racist car is traveling in the wrong direction. And these two cars are racing
toward each other. Isn't that going to be a profound, dangerous collision?
Well, we've been bumping cars really from the founding of this country.
Ibram Kendi, we have to end there, but thank you very much for being on Hard Talk.
You're welcome.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content. APM, American Public Media. With support from Battelle, counterfeit microelectronics can cause critical systems to fail when we need them most. Battelle is developing advanced solutions for government and commercial clients. More at battelle.org.
If your organization is hosting a free event or has a need for volunteers, consider getting the word out with a public service announcement on WBEZ. We air PSAs throughout every day, And our listeners appreciate learning about local events and opportunities to help their neighborhoods and communities. You can view our full guidelines for submission at wbez.org/PSA. WBEZ is supported by UChicago's Master of Liberal Arts, a sample class discussing the problem of evil from the Book of Job to No Country for Old Men, is open to all, August 8th downtown. graham.uchicago.edu/MLA.
Because I have had to stay strong for my family.
He's trying to help with two younger brothers. All three were born in the U.S.
My mom's afraid now because ever since they got my father, there has been no calls from him, no contact, and we've tried to see where he is, but the most we've gotten is that he's in Louisiana.
His parents came into the country illegally from Guatemala 18 years ago and settled in Mississippi. Lopez now fears his father will be deported.
I've just been mad about the whole thing, really, because the El Paso shooting had just happened a week ago, and then why would you give an order like that? For the raids to just happen like that when people are still grieving.
The Department of Homeland Security says the operation had been in the works for months and the timing was unfortunate. The fellowship hall at St. Anne's has been transformed into a triage of sorts where people can get legal advice, a hot meal, and meet with a social worker or child psychologist. Angel Lopez's mother has come here seeking guidance.
No sé qué hacer.
Basically, it's that my mom doesn't know what to do at this point because my dad was the one bringing in everything for us. And seeing the way things are now, she's confused at what to do because she has to take care of her autistic son and she has to provide for me and my brother.
Father Odell Medina estimates at least 100 families from the 800-person parish are affected one way or another. Some are back after being released, but others have not been heard from.
The system sees numbers. I know the people by name. I know that they are hard workers. They are people of faith. They are family people, community people. They were not in a Walmart killing somebody else. They were working.
But federal authorities say the arrest should not come as a surprise. Mike Hurst is the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Mississippi. He says the raids were about enforcing law and order.
But while we do welcome folks from other countries, they have to follow our laws. They have to abide by our rules. They have to come here legally, or they shouldn't come here at all.
Hurst had a warning for employers as well.
To those who use illegal aliens for a competitive advantage or to make a quick buck, if we find that you have violated federal criminal law, we're coming after you.
The enforcement has left a community gripped with fear.
Everybody's like paranoid.
Evelyn is a 20-year-old born in Mississippi to parents who came here from Guatemala.
Has everybody worried and scared? Because now they don't want to come out the house. They don't want to go get anything, not even go to the store.
She doesn't want to use her last name because her father was arrested, and she says her family is traumatized and fears further repercussions. Her 10-year-old brother, Darby, is distraught from what happened last Wednesday.
And it was like the second day of school. I came back because I was knocking on the door. Nobody answered.
He eventually found his mother hiding in a car with some relatives. She had been running late for work the day of the raids and avoided arrest. Now she's afraid to go back to her job. Evelyn says it took 3 days to find out that her father is being held at a detention center in Natchez, Mississippi. They're not sure what's next, so they've come to the church to seek answers. Lawyers are staffing these makeshift legal clinics in several of the towns hit by the ICE raids. Attorney Amelia McGowan with the Mississippi Center for Justice says there are few pro bono immigration lawyers practicing in Mississippi, but now several hundred attorneys from around the country have signed up to help.
Many of these cases are going to be very long. They might take years to finish. And so we want to make sure we have a sustainable network in place to really support people through the entire process.
As lawyers scramble to help people navigate the immigration system, back at St. Anne's Church, Father Medina is working to set up humanitarian aid for the long term.
Thank you.
Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Carthage, Mississippi.
It's